This is Culturetopia, a weekly blast of NPR love for all things cultural. I'm Netta Ulaby, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Linda Holmes, editor of NPR's pop culture blog, Monkey See, where you can find all the stories we've excerpted and subscribe to our podcast. This week, we have sonnets, we have villains, we have legends.
As an acting legend, Sidney Poitier, talking about his new memoir. We'll hear some Latin Jewish hip-hop and hear from British author Clive James.
But first, we'll stop by the movie theater. This week, A Night at the Museum, Battle of the Smithsonian, was the top draw, edging out the latest Terminator tale. NPR's Elizabeth Blair attended a press conference with some of the actors and the film's director that was anything but serious. She also spoke to a museum curator who was bemused by the Hollywood treatment.
Some of the things they're having the airplanes do are a bit of a stretch. They have the Wright Flyer flying down the hall through a door and outside with a passenger on board. The real Wright Flyer could barely get out of its own way. Totally preposterous, but great.
Here's Bob Vanderlinden, a serious curator who works with historic facts all day, clearly charmed by the whole experience. Turns out during filming, director Sean Levy had a tougher time dealing with the fictional properties.
There's a scene where Darth Vader and Oscar the Grouch approach Hank Azaria's evil pharaoh.
Is that you breathing? Because I can't hear myself think.
Sounds like Darth Vader was a bit of a diva.
There's a guy who wears the suit, and he showed up on the set, but there's also Lord Vader's handler. And this is a representative from Lucasfilm, who is a lovely woman who stood there next to Darth Vader all day. And occasionally, she would say, Vader wouldn't do that. And I was like, really? Vader can't, like, shake his head in frustration? No, it's Darth Vader. He wouldn't do that. And there are these unspoken, like, codes of behavior for Lord Vader that this woman was there policing.
Boy, there's nothing that somebody doesn't have an opinion on whether it could really happen in real life.
It's a little hard to believe that Night at the Museum beat out the latest Terminator movie for the top box office slot this weekend. Terminator Salvation is the latest installment of a film franchise that's been going since 1984. NPR's Bob Mondello had this review.
You'd think The End of the World, which more or less happened in the third Terminator flick, would take some of the pressure off a series, but fans have still been fretting about this new movie. Christian Bale threw a temper tantrum on the set, then got upstaged by his unknown co-star, Sam Worthington, and it did not exactly inspire confidence that the director's previous hits were both Charlie's Angels movies. Of course, some might consider that perfect training for a story about wiping out all of humanity. Gives you a reason, no?
Come with me if you want to live.
That line is a quote from Terminator 2, one of several in-jokes in the new film that will amuse fans, but that don't exactly brighten with comedy, a movie that is very effectively grim. We're no longer in an hasta la vista, baby world. We've leaped ahead to 2018, post-apocalypse. The machines have done their dirty work, and humanity is on the...
Run!
Charlie's Angels, it's not. Director McGee, borrowing a technique from war movies, so drains the screen of color he almost seems to be shooting in black and white. Happily, his way with special effects is indeed special, whether he's sending giant metal transporters to snatch up people like peanuts from a bowl, or mechanical eels to thrash the audience to death. It's a little odd when an enormous transformer-like thingy wanders on shedding deadly motorcycles as if they were fleas. It looks like an escapee from a much dumber summer movie. But it still helps make Terminator Salvation breathless and nerve-jangling. If it's not really engaging emotionally, well, the Terminator franchise sort of teaches you not to get too attached to its good guys. Christian Bale is either the fourth, fifth, or sixth actor to play John Connor, depending on whether you count the TV series and the flashbacks. And given the rather wayward way these films have with time travel, if he makes one wrong step in some future past, the character might not even exist next time around. But then, if you want an extended relationship, you probably shouldn't be at a franchise called Terminator, right? I'm Bob Mondello.
We'll stay in Hollywood a little bit longer. Morning Edition paid a visit this week to Hollywood in an interview with actor Sidney Poitier. The occasion was the publication of his memoir, Life Beyond Measure. In this very moving segment of the interview, NPR's Renee Montaigne asked him about leaving his family to seek his fortune in the U.S. from his home in the Bahamas.
This book is written as a series of letters to your great-granddaughter, and you share memories of the people that have touched your life as a sort of gift to her. and an instructive one. And of all the luminaries that you have known, you end the chapter on people of courage with your father. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking up the whole time we've been talking, I'm seeing over your shoulder a silver frame with a photograph of your mother and father.
Yeah. Oh, yes, that's that.
Yeah. Yeah. What was it about him?
My dad, he was honest. My father was the quintessential husband and dad. When I left to go to Miami, he gave me a lecture on the dock, and he told me what I must make sure I try to do with myself. And then he put $3 in my hand. And he said to me, he said, take care of yourself, son. And he stood there on the docks waiting for the boat to take off, and it did. And I'm looking back at him, and I knew what he was thinking. He was thinking about whether he and my mother had given me enough before I had to go out into the world. And I think now that they did. He gave me infinitely more than the $3 he put in my hand.
If you'd like to see clips of Sidney Poitier performing in films like Blackboard Jungle and Lilies of the Field, they're on our website, npr.org. British author Clive James has also published his own memoirs. He told Morning Edition about a childhood escapade that almost cost him his life.
I was a big fan of the movie serials. We used to go to the movies every Saturday, all my bunch of kids, and you'd see 16 cartoons and about half a dozen episodes from different serials, The Lost City of the Jungle, Batman. I wanted to be one of these people, superheroes, and I invented a character of myself called the Flash of Lightning. And in this outfit, when dusk fell, only after dark, I would suddenly appear silhouetted against the stars on the back fence, ready for my progress from yard to yard along the street. But I almost killed myself then, too, because I was coming home one night quite late and climbing our back fence, and I slipped and fell, and the little piece of rope that held my cape around my neck caught in the top paling of the fence, and I was hanging there, strangling. And that would have been the end of me if the rope hadn't broken and I hadn't fallen straight into the cabbage patch. But that was the biggest adventure the Flash of Lightning ever had. He hung up his cape after that, but he's still in my mind. I'm still him, in a way.
Lynn Neary had a story this week about another British author who's a little older than Clive James. This year marked the 400th anniversary of the publication of Shakespeare's sonnets, his eloquent and emotional thoughts on love. Lynn's story raised the question, did he really mean for them to be published?
What does this...
Well, you can tell everybody down in Old Frisco, tell them Tiny Montgomery says hello.
...have in common with this?
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date.
Well, Clinton Halen thinks quite a lot. When Halen was researching a book on bootleggers in the music industry during the 1970s, he discovered that a lot of Shakespeare's plays had been bootlegged as well, and that got him curious about the sonnets. The result is his new book, So Long as Men Can Breathe, the story of how the sonnets came to be published and what happened to them over the years. To begin with, Halen says, Bob Dylan's basement tapes and Shakespeare's sonnets were never intended for a wide audience.
Essentially, in both cases, they were killing time and at the same time dealing with huge personal issues in a private way, which they never conceived of coming out publicly.
So how did the sonnets come to be published 400 years ago? As Halen tells it, Elizabethan publishing was a murky, anarchic business. It wasn't hard for an enterprising publisher to get his hands on a manuscript without the author's approval. Halen believes Thomas Thorpe, the man who published the sonnets, did just that.
This was a man who lived on the very periphery of the London publishing world, who struggled to make ends meet, who was constantly in trouble with the stationer's company for publishing books that flagrantly breached the copyright of other publishers. You know, this is somebody who, if he got his hands on Shakespeare's sonnets, must have done so in some kind of underhanded, slightly questionable way.
But why was Shakespeare so intent on keeping the sonnets private? That gets to some of the most controversial questions about the sonnets. Most of the poems are addressed to a fair youth, and his identity has been the source of endless academic debate. Halen believes it was William Herbert, Earl of Pembroke.
He had a fairly wild youth. He was known to play both sides of the field. He was a poet in his own right. He was certainly a lusty young lord. So a lot of the details that are in the sonnets imply that type of personality is the fair youth.
And here's the tricky part, the part that those of us who have not been following the academic debates over the years may not have known. Many scholars believe the sonnets are autobiographical, which means the sonnets addressed to the fair youth are Shakespeare's expressions of love for him. They point to poems like Sonnet 20 as an example. Here's an excerpt.
And for a woman wert thou first created, till nature as she wrought thee fell a-doting, and by addition me of thee defeated, by adding one thing to my purpose, nothing. But since she pricked thee out for women's pleasure, mine be thy love, and thy love's use their treasure.
It is for this reason, says Halen, that Shakespeare never wanted the sonnets published and may even have sought to have the Thorpe edition suppressed.
If the sonnets are interpreted in what I think these days would be considered a fairly normal way, which is that they're about a homosexual affair with a peer, he was committing several criminal offences. I mean, it would have been extremely socially sensitive for him to have any kind of scandal that involved him and a male peer.
The highly personal nature of the poem, says Halen, was a radical departure for an Elizabethan writer. In the sonnets, Shakespeare revealed himself far more than he ever did in the plays.
Wordsworth talked about these sonnets as the key that unlocked his heart. And that might be a slight overstatement, but it's only a slight one. I mean, they are an insight into who the man was, and it's likely to be the closest we're ever going to get to the mind of William Shakespeare.
The Thorpe edition of the sonnets disappeared and did not resurface for almost 200 years. There are only 13 copies of the original publication left, but nothing could diminish the emotional power and popularity of some of the greatest love poems ever written. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
So long as men can breathe, and so long as women can blog. Linda, are some of your favorite blog postings from Monkey See this week?
Well, the world of pop culture was dominated last week by the end of American Idol, which wrapped its eighth season last week with the crowning of the winner, who turned out to be not the most talked about contestant of the year, who's named Adam Lambert, but another guy whose name is Chris Allen, who is a much more, I think a lot of people would feel, a much more mainstream candidate for the crown. And we talked on the blog this week about both what Chris Allen had done right to win the prize, and also one of our contributors, Mark Hirsch, who's a music writer, spoke a little bit about why in many ways Allen made a more compelling and interesting story, even though he was not the person who got the most press during the season. So we talked quite a bit about that and about some pivotal performances, and we have links to those performances on the blog, and you can actually see for yourself who these guys are and whether you you think you would award them anything, let alone something as prominent in the media as the victory on a very highly rated television show.
What I loved is that you gave 5 points of what the winner did to earn his position as the idol. And that was an analysis that I haven't seen anywhere else, and it was incredibly trenchant. So if you're listening to this podcast and you haven't read Linda's analysis, it'll only make sense to you if you've been watching American Idol, but it will make you wish that you'd been watching it. We're going to turn now to another kind of musical group, one that has not yet found traction in mainstream television, or at least not as much as perhaps it deserves. It's a group called the Hip Hop Judios. Josh Norick and Abraham Velez combine Jewish and Latino culture with the hip hop music they grew up loving. They explained to Tell Me More's Michelle Martin that their group is an outlet for other Jews with hip hop leanings.
I don't want to call it a goof. I think that from the start, though, we were very deliberate about getting away from that. Unfortunately, Jewish hip-hop has been marred exactly by what you said about, Two Live Jews and schlock rock, and it's like, why does Jewish hip hop always have to be nebbishy sheepish?
Beastie Boys and Third Base have Jewish MCs, so it's that there aren't credible. Jewish hip hop.
But in terms
artists.
Of, for me, I'd say an act that really inspired me in my youth was a band called Blood of Abraham, and these were openly Jewish MCs who were produced by Eazy-E of N.W.A. and marketed mostly to an African American audience. Certainly, I was a huge Beastie Boy and Third Base fan, but I always felt like they kind of kept their identity in the closet. Mm. Whereas, you know, Blood of Abraham, these guys were up front, and I also saw that they were successful in crossing over to a mostly non-religious, not necessarily Jewish audience. And I think that when Abe and I started Hip Hop Judios, I realized we had that potential as well to, be openly Jewish, but connect with audiences, whether they're Latino Jewish, not Jewish. I mean, we have fans in France, and then when we go there, they just speak French, and I don't know why they enjoy us. But I think that our music thankfully transcends that musical ghetto, so to speak.
Talk to me, if you would, about Ocho Candelicas. Would it be fair to call it a Hanukkah song?
Sure. It's a reworking of a song that's in Ladino, and that's a language that was spoken by the Jews of Spain. It's a song I remember hearing my father sing as a child, and I always thought it would be fun to do a more punk rock hip-hop version of it.
Well, there, here it is, Ocho Candelicas. See, you're schooling me here. I just thought it was a punk Hanukkah song. I didn't realize it was an even deeper heritage to that.
It's a little further into what I sometimes call a punk hop groove.
So I assume that you are not the only two members of the Latino Jewish community. Is there a center of gravity to the community that you draw upon for inspiration? And are they fans, or are they just appalled by what you're doing?
Appalled? Why do you say appalled? Well, there are a few different segments to this community, as with so many other communities. For example, at shows that we've played in New York, there's an older generation Sephardic community, and I think that they were sort of intrigued, somehow heard about the song that you just played, Ocho Candelicas, and may have at times been a little horrified by some of the other things that we did in our set. And then we have sometimes a younger set of people who are like me. Part of the family is Jewish, part of the family is non-Jewish Latino, and they've heard of us, and I think for them there's a certain coming out feeling about it, you know, that, oh, okay, they're representing, and so there's some of that segment of the community.
Yeah, and I would say, like, from our website, periodically we get an email that'll say, like, Dear Hip Hop Judios, I live in Las Cruces, New Mexico. I am, like, 1/20th Jewish. I've traced my ancestry to Sephardic Jews from Spain who came to the New World in, like, 1500. And there are a group of people known as Crypto Jews or Marranos who live in New Mexico who are descended of people escaping the Inquisition. Mm. They reach out to us and they'll just be like, I really dig what you're doing. Thanks.
What kinds of crowds come to your shows, and does it vary depending on what part of the country you're in? Josh?
Oh, yeah, it absolutely varies. When we've done shows on the West Coast in L.A., I think out here, because Latin alternative music is pretty popular, we're perceived as just a straight-up Latin alternative act that happens to also be Jewish, and we've done shows that have been probably more than half Chicano. And when we're playing in New York, definitely probably draws more of a Jewish hipster Upper West Side crowd, right, Abe? I mean, when you say it's,
I would say so.
Yeah, yeah, it's different every place you go.
The next story is about Muzak, the canned music that it used to be common to hear in places like department stores and dentists' offices. Some people call it elevator music, but I have to say I don't recall ever hearing music in elevators. Have you ever heard music in elevators?
Not like the Hip Hop Judios.
Exactly. Maybe elevators in hotels. At any rate, Muzak has been updated. It's almost hip, but like a lot of other things right now, it is in financial trouble. Reporter Greg Collard has this story.
Elevator music made Muzak a huge success, but Sean Mosley says it's also made the company a punchline.
Every day I have to have a conversation with somebody and say, we're not elevator music, we're not your father's Muzak.
Mosley works at Muzak's headquarters in Fort Mill, South Carolina. The place is actually hip. Music is everywhere you go. There are more than 250 speakers in this huge warehouse that has a sort of modern stainless steel look inside. But Muzak's been around for 75 years. Bruce McKagan is Muzak's unofficial docent. His tour includes interesting historical tidbits, like former President Lyndon Johnson owning a Muzak franchise in Austin, Texas.
And Lyndon Johnson sold it to the White House while Eisenhower was there. Yeah, so there was Muzak in the White House because of LBJ. Isn't that great story?
But again, this isn't your father's Muzak. Stephen Pilker is in charge of today's sound. He heads Muzak's audio architecture unit. This is the group that creates many of those mixtapes you hear when you go out to eat or shop, say, at an AT&T store.
Like someone like Mosquitoes that you would not necessarily associate with a mainstream act. But it's perfect for someone like AT&T. It's very lively. It's very springy without being over the top.
Pilker says many of his audio architects are musicians or used to work in independent record stores. No, they're not music snobs. Pilker says they're just passionate.
You hear something casually and you start, you know, you're watching television or you're in a bar and you're like, God, this would totally fit for this client. Like, you don't really ever turn off from that job experience.
Sounds like a cool job, but Muzak isn't hiring a lot these days. In February, it filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy with $436 million in debt. The stock market declined, and a failed merger with a competitor made things worse. Muzak is heard in 350,000 locations, but that number hasn't changed since 2005. Standard & Poor's analyst Hal Diamond says Muzak has new competition.
Now when you walk into a store, you may have, video and people are carrying iPods with them everywhere they go. So this has restricted Muzak's ability to raise prices as well.
The typical business pays Muzak $50 a month. That cost varies depending on location, the number of businesses in a chain, and customization of playlists. Muzak has a plan to make itself more valuable as the privately held company tries to emerge from bankruptcy later this year. It now offers in-store video signage and a service that tries to connect products to songs, like a free song download if you buy, say, a bottle of shampoo. Yes, the name Muzak carries some baggage, but it also has its advantages. As Muzak's Sean Mosley points out, at least prospective clients always take his calls. For NPR News, I'm Greg Collard in Charlotte, North Carolina.
So that's what Muzak sounds like these days.
Almost hip. It's a generous assessment, but it'll do for now. Thanks for joining us this week on Culturetopia. I'm Netta Ulavi.
And I'm Linda Holmes. And you can find links to all the stories we had today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia.